Our speaker really doesn't need an introduction, but for those of you who are new, he served in a student capacity here, also working on the staff. He not only graduated from here and has pastored, he served on our board of incorporate members for a number of years before being tapped to be the fourth president of Dallas Theological Seminary. In 2001, he stepped aside from that to give attention to a little church growth project in Frisco, Texas, called Stonebriar Community Church that has ballooned, and God has blessed, and they're having a great time there. He continues to write, obviously, and speak, and therefore broadcast on Insight for Living around the world. But we are deeply grateful that he continues to partner with us here at DTS. Would you join me in welcoming our chancellor, and dear friend, Dr. Charles Swindoll, to our chapel this morning.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I especially want to welcome our guests on campus today. We're glad you've chosen to get a good look at us and to visit our classrooms and to spend time with these men and women who are our faculty. We commend you for choosing Dallas as one of those in the finalists of your future, and especially happy to have you here to enjoy the events of the day. My granddaughter's sitting here somewhere. I want her to stand up, and she's the one with the red face. So, Heather, stand up and let everybody see where you are. There, right in the middle. Oh, good. All right. I've got her arm behind her back, twisting it, saying it's got to be Dallas Seminary. Of course, she's already convinced. She wants to skip undergraduate work. And she said, look, Bubba, you've been to president. You can get me in right now. And so she's looking at either Wheaton or Texas A&M. What do you think? Oh, I knew that was coming. I want to talk to you today about something that will make or break your years at Dallas Seminary. What I have to say has really very little, if anything, to do with academics. It has very little to do with grade point average, probably nothing, truth be told. What I want to talk about, however, has everything to do with your future. How you will relate to people, how influential and significant the places you minister will become, and most of all, how deeply different you will be as a person if you learn to control this problem. I want to talk about attitude. Really, a part of attitude that comes out in complaining and grumbling and grousing, and there's another word that I won't mention, but it also fits. It has to do with the stuff that comes out of our mouths because we don't like what's going on, or we wish it were different, or it isn't like we expected, and on and on and on it goes. I was speaking at a little luncheon we had sponsored by the seminary last Thursday, and shared a story about old Elmer, who's about 80 years old, lying in a hospital bed, and he says, Ethel, is that you right there? And his wife of 56 years says, yeah, Elmer, it's me. I'm right here. He opened one eye and he said, I remember 55 years ago being in a veterans hospital in San Francisco. You were right there then too, weren't you, Ethel? She said, yeah, I was right there. And he said, I remember in 64 when we lost our house, burned to the ground. You were right there then, weren't you, when we lost our house, lost everything. She sighed and thought back and said, yeah, I was right there. And I remember when we went through that terrible financial crunch, and I lost my job at the shop, and we wound up with nothing to live on. You were there then too, weren't you? She looked out the window and remembered and said, "Yeah, Elmer, I was there." He looked out over the top of his glass. He says, "You know, Ethel, you're bad luck." You know, you try to think about living with a guy like that for 56 years. Some people see the glass as half full, and others see the same glass as what? Half empty. It's the same glass, same amount of water, same set of circumstances. The difference is in attitude. Tucked away in Philippians 2 is one verse that can haunt you on this subject. It is at verse 14 in this great second chapter, which we tend to stop reading about verse 11, unfortunately. And verse 14 sort of slides in the back door and grabs you around the throat. It's a direct command, and Paul doesn't stutter, and the writing is clear. Little more is seen in the verse, even if you knew the original. He names two things we're to stop doing. He makes it so clear you can't miss it. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. I remember taking a Greek class with Stan Toussaint. Is he here today? I was going to look at him when I told this story. I remember his saying, "Now, gentlemen," back then it was all men at the seminary. He said, "Now, gentlemen, this is an onomatopoetic word." I thought, boy, that'll change your life right there. And he said, it's one of those words that sounds like its meaning, like drip, 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 or swoosh, or maybe murmur, which is this one, goguzo. So he kind of walked around the class going, goguzo, goguzo, goguzo. It's one of the few Greek words I remember without ever checking now. It just kind of stuck in my mind. It sounds like goguzo, goguzo, murmuring, murmuring. I can't believe the tuition. It's so expensive. I can't believe the weather in Dallas is so hot. I mean, who does Dr. So-and-so think I am? A computer giving us all this reading. And why do we have to take this course? I took it in Bible school, and it was taught a lot better there than it is at a seminary. And don't tell me that guy's speaking in chapel again. And oh, man, we got to endure that again. And if Chaplain Bill blows that horn one more time, I am going to throw up. I mean, on and on and on, complaining, complaining, arguing. The first word means to murmur, to grumble. The next word means to argue. And if there's one place you can find a whole lot of that right here is at this seminary, right here toward the end of the semester, which is where we're moving rapidly these days. And unless I miss my guess, some of you have fallen into that trap. The glass is either half full or it's half empty. Now, what Paul addresses in such strong words, it's illustrated in an unforgettable manner over in Numbers chapters 10 and 11. Turn back. From Philippians 2, go back to Numbers 10. By the way, even if you complain and grouse and murmur, progress doesn't stop. Life goes on. There's an old Arab proverb I read recently: the dogs may bark, but the caravan moves on. No amount of murmuring is going to slow the school down. It's just going to slow you down. Your learning ability will be put on hold. Furthermore, your spiritual life will cool, as happened to the people who had experienced the Exodus under Moses. Now, even before we look at these two chapters rather quickly, just stop and think. Think of the contrast. For 400 and more years, they and their forefathers had been slaves of Egypt, living under the harsh lash of the taskmaster in the ghetto of Goshen. No longer. They're now free. And they're not under Pharaoh any longer. They're under Moses. And early on, when they got to the Red Sea and the army was chasing them, there was that remarkable miracle where the sea opened and they went through on dry ground, and then the sea came back over the Egyptians and wiped them out. That's happened. When they're thirsty, there's water that comes from the rock miraculously. When they're hungry, there's manna that comes from the Lord. The psalmist calls it angel food. It's magnificent. When they don't know where they ought to go or when, all they have to do is look up over the tabernacle, and there's this cloud that gives them shade in the day and warmth in the cold desert night. And it moves, they move. It stays, they stay. It's fantastic. I mean, you can't miss. And it won't be long before they will live in cities they didn't build, and they'll drink from wells they didn't dig, and they'll eat from vines and trees they didn't plant, and they'll enjoy homes they didn't construct and furnish. I mean, all of that is right there. The glass seems more than half full. Verse 11 of chapter 10, they've just finished their time at Sinai. And by the way, I should mention, if they don't know what God expected, just read the stones. He's now put it in writing. Came about in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, that the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. Here it is now. And the sons of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sinai. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. And so they moved out for the first time according to the command of the Lord through Moses. Verse 33, thus they set out from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, with the Ark of the Covenant and the Lord journeying in front of them for the 3 days to seek out a resting place for them. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. I mean, how good is that? I mean, what do they need? Nothing. What was missing? Well, to them, many of them, you can believe it, Egypt. They'd gotten used to Egypt. I mean, it's hot here. It was a lot cooler by the waters of the Nile. And it's uncomfortable. We don't have our shacks we used to live in. Now we're out on the ground, and we're sort of at the mercy of the elements. I mean, it's not like where we have been for these years. Like folks come to the seminary and it's, you know, fall isn't like it was in Cincinnati. Well, duh, this isn't Cincinnati. You think fall's bad, wait till summer. I mean, you'll never lack for an illustration on hell. I'll guarantee you that when Dallas kicks in full bore. It's not like it used to be at your place on the West Coast or where you were reared in New England. Last time I checked, it's not anywhere near New England. But of course, if you determine to look at it that way, your perspective will turn you into a grumbler. It doesn't have to. John Hanna, a number of years ago, sent me a terrific letter from a scout who wrote his mom. Scout's name is Cole, and his mom gets this letter from the scout camp. Imagine being the mother. The dead. Dear Mom and Dad, our scoutmaster told us to write to our parents in case you saw the flood on TV and are worried. We're okay. Only one of our tents and 2 sleeping bags got washed away. Luckily, none of us drowned because we were all up on the mountains looking for Chad when it happened. Oh yeah, please call Chad's mother and tell her he's okay now. He can't write because of the cast. I got to ride in one of the search and rescue jeeps. It was neat. We never would have found him in the dark if it hadn't been for the lightning. Our scoutmaster, Walt, got mad at Chad for going on a hike alone without telling anybody. Chad said he did tell him, but it was during the fire, so he probably didn't hear him. Did you know that if you put gasoline on a fire, the gas can will blow up? Did you know that? The wet wood didn't burn, but one of the tents did. David's going to look weird till his hair grows back. We'll be home on Saturday, Mom, if Scoutmaster Walt gets his car fixed. It wasn't his fault about that wreck. The brakes worked okay when we left. Scoutmaster Walt said that the car that old, in a car that old, you have to expect something to break down. That's probably why he can't get any insurance. We think it's a neat car. He doesn't care if we get it dirty, and if it's hot, sometimes he lets us ride out on the fenders. Gets pretty hot with 10 people in one car. He lets us take turns riding in the trailer until the highway patrol man stopped and talked to us about that. Scoutmaster Walt's a neat guy. He's a good driver. In fact, he is teaching Terry how to drive on the mountain roads where there isn't much traffic. Did you know you don't need guardrails on roads that don't have much traffic? All we ever see up there are logging trucks. This morning, all the guys were diving off the rocks and swimming out in the lake. Scoutmaster Walt wouldn't let me because I can't swim. And Chad was afraid he would sink because of his cast. So he let us take a canoe all by ourselves across this big lake. It was great. You can still see some of the trees under the water from a flood. Scoutmaster Walt isn't crabby like some scoutmasters. He didn't even get mad about our losing the life jackets. He has to spend a lot of time working on the car, so we're trying not to cause him any trouble. Guess what? We've all passed our first aid merit badges. When Dave dove in the lake and cut his arm, we got to see how a tourniquet works. Wade and I threw up, but Scoutmaster Walt said it probably was just food poisoning from the leftover chicken. He said they got sick that way with food they ate in prison. I'm really glad he got out and became our scoutmaster. He said he sure figured out how to get things done better while he was doing time. I have to go now. We're going to town to mail our letters and buy bullets. Don't worry, Mom. Don't worry about anything. We're fine. Love, Cole. Now, there's a kid that's got a lot of things to complain about, but he's not complaining. Life's great. Life's great when you're a kid. You get kind of grousy when you get older and you start thinking about all this. I mean, can you imagine that mother? Ralph, come here. Listen. I mean, all she could think of was the danger. Not that kid, not Cole. Man, he's having the time of his life. What in the world's wrong with these people? Why in the world do we read what we read in verses 1 through 6 of chapter 11? The people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. Hebrews a little squirrely here. It seems to best say, now the people became truly murmurous, an offense to the Lord's ears. Don't forget that. Things got a little hot. Things got a little long. Diet got a little boring. Classes got a little wearisome. Moses got a little tired. Life got a little oppressive. The people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of the place is called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Now please keep reading. There's a whole new group that emerges. There's some of this group in every student body. Text here calls it the rabble. The rabble. They're the ones who lead the complaining that's going on in the student body. The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" They got manna coming out the wazoo. I mean, every day they want to have something to eat. All they got to do is wait till the morning caterer arrives. It's going to come. It's going to be fresh. I know. They got to go back to Moses, you know, his wife's 1,001 Ways to Cook Manna cookbook in order to know how to keep it fresh. They'd sliced it and baked it and eaten it raw and put it in sandwiches and tried every way in the world to make it tasty, and they're getting sick and tired of manna. And that's all their focus is. The glass is half empty. Who will give us meat to eat? We remember, listen to this, verse 5, here we go. We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt. They hated Egypt back when they were in Egypt, but now all they could think of was the fish they got free when they lived back there, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic and the melanta, all that goes with that. And now our appetite is gone. There's nothing at all except this manna. And the way it's written is kind of with gritted teeth. All he got now is this same stuff. Let me tell you something. Magic doesn't happen when you matriculate into the student body. One of the best pieces of advice I got from a fellow who had just graduated when I was about to experience my first year. He said, if you think you're moving to a utopia, get that out of your mind really quick. You're going to see the flesh at work like you've rarely seen it at work. You're going to meet guys and you're going to see even some profs that are going to really be a challenge to you. It isn't perfect. But it's magnificent, depending on your attitude. Some people graduate and think, good riddance. Not many, but some. Most of us graduated thinking, boy, that was a major, major milestone. I've spent the rest of my years saying, thank you, Lord. Thank you. For a handful of faculty members who would invest their lives in me and my classmates. Thank you for principles that I was able to pick up. Thank you for directions that still work as the years pass. Thank you for this school that keeps standing firm. Thank you. There's none of that here. Manna is described for us, and the grousing goes on so long it finally gets to Moses. That can happen, can't it? Don't answer out loud, faculty. But sometime you can encounter such a negative spirit among the students that it finally gets to you. And you go home at night and you say to your partner, why in the world do I keep doing this? Why in the world is this continuing to be the spirit among us? So you get discouraged. In fact, Moses, we read in verse 10, when he heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man in the doorway of his tent, Moses was displeased. So it's a word we could translate depressed, I suppose. He's low. The glass suddenly got half full or half empty. He now can't get above it. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you been so hard on your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all the people on me? Look at the change in perspective. The burden wasn't on Moses. It's on the Lord. But when your attitude gets cloudy, your whole perspective changes. And usually you look for somebody to blame. And what was it I who conceived all this people? Was it I who brought them forth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing infant to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. Notice their focus is on what they didn't have rather than on the many things they did have. Give us meat. I don't have meat. Where do I get the meat? Lord, please. And then it got even worse. Verse 14, I alone am not able to carry all this people. It's too burdensome for me. So if you're going to deal thus with me, kill me. Just finish me off. Do it at once if I have found favor in your sight. Don't let me see my wretchedness. He is at the bottom. When you get there, it's a little frightening. We've all been there. You especially experience this when you're surrounded by negativism. Before long, it just comes in on you like a flood. These are the same people who have just been celebrating the Exodus. Now they hit a few challenges along the way, and it's like, where is God? Why in the world did we ever leave that comfortable place? And by the way, while they were there, they hated it. So the Lord steps on the scene, and as he always does, he brings answers that are surprising. He tells Moses he needs to have others shoulder the load with him, so he makes plans for that. And he says in verse 18, this gets really a little humorous, say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall have meat. You want meat? I'll bring you a little meat. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, not 2 days, not 5 days, 19, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month of meat. You're going to have meat till you're ready to scream. And verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true or not. So Moses gets the people together, gets a team together, and it begins to work. They shoulder the load, and now watch what happens. Verse 30, Moses returned to the camp, both he and the elders of Israel. Now there went forth a wind from the Lord. It brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. People spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered last gathered 10 omers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. I mean, I love to hunt. And I love to dove hunt, but I've never seen anything like this. Neither had they. I mean, they're now wading through it. Ron Allen, in his work on Expositor's Bible Commentary, writes this. This is so like Ron. The scene must have been similar to a riot. People screaming, birds flapping their wings everywhere, the pell-mell movement of meat-hungry people in a sea of birds. Dare we picture people ripping at the birds, eating flesh before cooking it? Bestial in behavior? They must have been like a sugar-crazed boy in a child's daydream, afloat on a chocolate sandwich cookie raft in a sea of chocolate syrup, nibbling at the cookie before drowning in the dark, sweet sea. Isn't that a good way to put it? I bet the editor of this goes, "You, I want to keep that in that." I think it's fantastic. I mean, look at this. We got quail everywhere. Now, the next verse is so telling. 33, while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people and struck the people with a plague. And they died, and they named the place the Graves of Craving, littered with shallow graves, with mouths full of quail. Amazing. They got meat, but they didn't get what they were really looking for. I learned from Dr. Pentecost years ago, it takes a heavenly appetite to enjoy a heavenly food. It takes a heart that's right to take in 4 years or more at Dallas Seminary. And to keep your heart right, it takes a terrific attitude, and nobody can control it but you. No chapel message can throw a magic switch. If you're determined to fuss and gripe and complain, there's room to do that. And you'll get just enough to get by, and you'll get into ministry, and you'll still be doing it. And I've led enough churches to tell you that there are a lot of folks like that running around just waiting to make life miserable for the rest of the congregation. Complainers have a three-dimensional effect. Let me close with some of these thoughts. First, they have an effect on the complainer himself or herself. It denies that God is at work and in control. When you complain, you're denying that God is at work and in control. You're denying, you're questioning His sovereignty. He is not surprised at the workload, and He is not taken back at your situation. He knows exactly what He is about. But you begin to deny that. You begin to doubt that when you complain. I'll tell you the second, it affects other people. It demoralizes those who have to listen to your complaints. You're married, it demoralizes your mate. It demoralizes your kids. You're single, you're with a group, you study together, it demoralizes the group. It poisons their spirit. And I'll tell you something else, and I haven't had one faculty member mention this, but I know them well enough to know it's true. It demoralizes those who teach you. Just like it did with Moses, it discourages the one who's doing his best to get the big job done. Abraham Lincoln on one occasion wrote this about criticism. If I tried to answer all the criticism of me and all the attacks leveled at me, this office would be closed to all other business. My job is not pleasing people, but doing the best I can. If in the end I am found to be wrong, 10 legions of angels swearing I was right will not help me. But if the end proves me to have been right, then all of what is said about me now will amount to nothing. Learn in your years at this school to take it. Learn to take it. Or get out. Learn to tough it out. Learn to stay. And watch the cloud. And eat the manna. And trust your God. Face it, our blessings have far outnumbered our testings. Our future is far more exciting than our past. Our training is far ahead of the majority of those in the world who would love to know their Bibles. And I suggest we continue to stay positive about it. That glass isn't just half full. It's almost all the way full. Ken Gangle taught here for years, left in his legacy a number of great books. One is called Coaching Ministry Teams. In it, I found this story from Ken. When I began my doctoral study many years ago, I interviewed at two institutions, one of which was the University of Kansas. When I visited with the graduate dean in the School of Education at that school, we had a fascinating conversation that went something like this. "Did you say you are an administrator at a Bible college?" asked the dean. "Yes." Is that a church-related school of some kind?" Yeah. "Certainly church-related, but not affiliated with any particular denomination." Long pause. "I used to go to church. said the dean. Really? Tell me about it, responded Dr. Gangle. Yeah, I used to go to church, and I remember one thing about my church. What is that? They fight. Gangle concludes, I still find his response startling. Imagine the things he could have named: preaching, baptizing, buildings, music, laughter, denominational affiliation. Yet the man chooses to associate church people with quarreling. In a discussion with a person he had known for not more than 10 minutes. I love his summary statement. In my opinion, working at Unity in the congregation stands right beside proclaiming the gospel as two major priorities of ministry. Conquer your attitude before you step into service full time. If you don't, you're going to be part of the problem. We don't need any more fighters. We need builders. Those excited about what God's doing. Attitude of gratitude. A spirit that says, I can do this by the grace of God. Let's bow together. Father, we acknowledge that while we have only a few moments together, we have touched on a subject that will have a major impact in every life represented here. Those on the platform, those filling this chapel, those not even hearing what has been said. I realize now in my life from your teaching me, Lord, that attitude really is at the core of everything. Where it has become soiled and spoiled, I pray that you will clean it up. Get it back on its right feet. Change our hearts, Lord, so that we see the great things you're still doing, while not ignoring the challenge and the demands of the responsibilities. Thank you for this fine school, for the people who have filled these seats in years past, for the impact they are having in lives around the world. Continue to raise up men and women like that. Begin, even during these years of learning, in every heart. I pray in the name of Jesus. Everybody said, amen. You're dismissed.